All right, it's 1:15. I'm going to go ahead and get started. I want to make sure I end on time so that the next presenter has a good opportunity to get things set up. He's a good friend of mine and already warned me that he had a lot of things he needed to get hooked up in that half hour before. So we're going to try and end right on time. My name is Jeff Mieliff. I'm a senior program manager in the Exchange product group. I've been with Exchange for about 12 years in various engineering, development, test, program management roles. And I currently work in the Exchange customer experience team. So in that role, I split my time about half and half between working with some of our larger customers that seem to be having problems with Exchange. So I get to see a lot of the bad things that can happen with highly complex, very large-scale Exchange deployments, and then take that learning and go try and make the product better. And the other half of my job is actually working on engineering projects, actually getting new features into the product, into future releases. So we're here today to talk about Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2. We're going to go through some of the new features that we released in Service Pack 2, talk a little bit about how we create service packs, how we decide what goes in them, and we'll have some time for questions as well. So before I start, just want to thank you all for taking the time to come to Tech Ed. I'm really psyched to be kicking off the Exchange track here. We've got some good content all week long, and it's great to have all you here. So in terms of the four features that I'm going to be talking about in Service Pack 2, and there certainly are a number of other things that we released in Service Pack 2 other than these four things, the four really, really big features that that we've gotten a lot of great feedback on are the mini version of Outlook Web App, and we'll talk about what that is, why people use it, why people are interested. The Hybrid Configuration Wizard, I'm going to briefly touch on that. Address Book Policies, as well as the applicability of Address Book Policies to multi-tenant or hosted email systems. And OWA Cross-Site Silent Redirection, one of our favorite features internally. And then we'll talk a little bit about one of the new things that we released in our latest update rollup. So to start off with, maybe, there we go. Oop, skipped way ahead. All right, I'm not going to use the remote. So let's talk a little bit about Exchange SP2. So Exchange Service Pack 2 is the latest release of an extremely complex product. We have about 20 million lines of code in Exchange. Some of that code is actually very old code. Been around since the early days of Exchange, and we've just carried it forward over time. Some of it is brand new. From release to release, there are certain features, certain pieces of functionality that we choose to write from scratch, and certain things that we choose to just iterate on and take all the lessons learned from the previous release and just make things better. Every single one of those releases that we deliver to customers goes through a huge amount of testing internally. And I realize that customers do hit bugs, right? With an incredibly complex product like that, there are going to be bugs. There's bugs in every software product. I'm a software developer. I recognize that I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. We do what I would consider to be a very good job of testing for core scenarios with Exchange. One of our challenges is that the product is extremely flexible in the way you can deploy it and the way you can use it. And so what we run into frequently are ways that our customers deploy or use the product that we didn't anticipate. We enabled it because of that level of flexibility that we give you, but there's always things that we run into that we didn't anticipate, and that seems to be where we run into the nastiest bugs that we end up fixing later. So as we're going through that process, once we've released an initial version of a product and we start getting that feedback from all of you and the rest of our customers around the world, we're constantly going through and fixing things and fixing the test cases that we have in the engineering cycle to ensure that not only are we continuing to deliver those fixes, but we're also not regressing. We're not basically going backwards in terms of quality. Things are always getting better. That's the goal. So Service Pack 2 has actually been out for about 6 months. How many of you are running Service Pack 2 of Exchange 2010? Great. It's fantastic to see. we're always a little bit disappointed when we hear from customers who, you know, aren't staying as current as we would like them to. We think you'll have the best experience with Exchange by staying as current as you can. So in that 6 months, we've actually released three additional roll-up updates. Roll-up updates are basically a group of bug fixes that we produce on a more frequent cadence than service packs, where we're not introducing features. It's much more about just fixing a set of bugs that have been reported to us by customers or that we've found internally and know have high applicability to many customers. So we're actually constantly working on the next service pack, the next roll-up update, as well as the next major release of the product. We're typically working on at least three branches of the product simultaneously within Exchange and doing the kind of complex task of making sure that those changes that we're making in that product code go into potentially all three of those different branches of code. So Service Pack 2 contained about 600 bug fixes. And no, I'm not going to go through every one of them. I'm not going to go through any of them, actually. We do provide some information when we release a service pack or a roll-up update, an update roll-up, that actually talks about the major fixes that we think most of our customers should be aware of that are in that that package. So you can download those that documentation with the updates and get that information before you deploy the fixes in production. So it's important to remember that we don't fix every bug. I started off at Microsoft in test. My job was to ensure quality in the product, right? And to find issues and get them fixed. And one of the hardest things as a tester to learn when working at any sort of commercial software company is that at some point, some of those things are not going to get fixed, and that's just the way it is, right? We find a lot of issues internally, quite frankly, that we realize there's a very small chance that any of you will ever actually hit those problems, right? Just as you find issues with your Exchange deployments, and you may be the only person on the face of the planet that will ever hit that issue. And we have a hard time justifying fixing those for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is the resources associated with actually making the fix, testing the fix, and releasing the fix. It's not trivial. The other is that every time we touch a piece of that code, we run the risk of potentially regressing in other areas from a quality perspective. So we have to be very, very careful when we're changing a complex product like Exchange to make the right fixes at the right time. So as I put up here, you know, just because something makes us look bad or makes us look stupid, we're not necessarily going to fix it. And yeah, there are a lot of bugs that we run into after we've released a product that can make us look pretty stupid. So yeah, we can take that. We have pretty thick skin, and we deserve to sometimes. So let's talk a little bit about some of the new features in Service Pack 2, the first being the mini version of Outlook Web App. So how many of you remember OMA, Outlook Mobile Access, from a prior release of Exchange? A few of you, okay. So OMA was basically a phone browser-based interface into Exchange. It was a totally separate web application that we had in starting in Exchange 2003. And basically what you knew then as OMA is back today, but it's not called OMA. But OMA's in the URL, just to make it confusing. And actually, I was looking through the source code for this earlier in the week, and the term OMA is all over it. It's brand new code, but I'm fairly certain that the folks who were told to go off and make this happen were basically told, okay, remember that OMA thing? We're going to do that again, so build OMA. And then marketing came along and decided, nope, it's going to be OMA Mini. So we actually got some feedback from one particular geographical region that this was a really key feature that was needed in the Exchange product. Because in that region, or in that specific country, there are really a lot of handheld devices, phones particularly, that use this type of interface to get to email. That's just the way people work. They don't use ActiveSync. They're not, you know, storing a cached version of their mailbox on their phone. Anybody here happen to know what country that is, where we see a lot of that, other than Robert down front? Japan, that's exactly right. So this was primarily written for the Japanese market. But it certainly works in all of the languages that OWASP supports. And the reason that it works in all of the languages that OWA supports is that it's really OWA. Unlike our previous effort in this area, where we actually had a totally separate code base, totally separate application that was responsible for rendering something like this, this is actually really just OWA with some different forms. It's the same code, just a different user interface. So because of that, we actually get some kind of cool benefits in terms of management and administration. So it's very simple to enable and disable access. It's enabled by default, actually. But you can disable access for individual users using OWA mailbox policies that are assigned to users. And there's just an OWA mini enabled flag that you can set. Because it's just an alternative view of OWA, all of those segmentation features that we have in OWA mailbox policies, where you can turn off access to the calendar, turn off access to contacts, turn off access to all the different individual components within OWA, all of that actually gets inherited here. So if I disable access to Scott to be able to access his calendar, because I want to mess with him, he not only will not be able to get to the calendar in OWA, he won't see it in OWA Mini either, automatically. Active sync policies don't apply here. This has nothing to do with active sync. This is just OWA. So that's important to remember. So in terms of how this actually works behind the scenes, I love figuring out how things work. I love the, you know, all the shows on TV these days, how it's made and modern marvels and those kind of things. So when I get an opportunity like this to talk about new features, I love actually digging into the code and seeing how things are set up. So what's happening behind the scenes here when you install Service Pack 2 is that we're actually creating another OWA virtual directory under the existing OWA virtual directory, and it's called OMA. Like I said, you know, it's not OMA, but it's in the URL, just to confuse you. So the way it's actually working, it's configured to run the exact same code as OWA. It's the same binaries, the same everything. If you actually look at the path name in IIS where it's pointing, it's the exact same configuration as the OWA virtual directory. The only caveat to that is that we don't enable forms-based authentication by default. We're using basic authentication. When that application starts up, it goes and looks at what path it's running in, realizes that it's in that OMA path, and based on that, it uses an alternative set of ASP.NET forms, which are the more limited forms that that provide that phone-based UI. So it's actually an extraordinarily simple setup. It's all the same code that's in OWA, and you just get it out of the box by installing Service Pack 2. So that's OWA Mini in a nutshell. Moving on to the hybrid configuration wizard. And I'm not going to cover this in a lot of detail, and I'll tell you why in just a second. So the hybrid configuration wizard allows you to, in a very easy fashion, set up an on-premises Exchange deployment to work with Office 365 in such a way that you can have a set of users that are in the cloud and a set of users that are in your on-premises deployment, and you effectively have one organization, right? You can actually move users back and forth between the cloud fairly easily using the built-in tools for moving mailboxes in the product. You can have a single email namespace, effectively, where your users are receiving mail, and the system will route intelligently based on where your users are actually located. It's a very, very good way to certainly trial Office 365, figure out if it's right for you. You can have, you know, a set of users in the cloud and a set of users on-premises for some time period. We actually work with a lot of large organizations that intend to stay this way for a very long time. This is their preferred method of deploying an Office 365 environment. So back in the old days, before Service Pack 2, and before we released this, we had this huge checklist of all the steps you had to go through to get this working properly. And I'm one of the people who's actually gone through that checklist and tried to get this up and running. The challenge with that checklist that had around 49 individual steps in it is that every one of those steps was incredibly complicated. And if you just, you know, made one little typo in one of those 49 steps, you were basically, you know, screwed. The hybrid deployment wouldn't work properly in some way, and would likely be hard to troubleshoot to actually get things working properly. And you may not know until you got all the way to the end of the list that you'd actually made a mistake. So that's not, you know, something that we realistically want to expect a lot of our customers to be able to get through. So we built the hybrid configuration wizard. It now takes around 6 manual steps to get this up and running. And there's a lot of logic built into the hybrid config wizard that'll go and validate the inputs that you're providing to ensure that that the right things are happening behind the scenes. So the reason I'm not going to go into much detail here is that this is a big enough deal that we actually have a separate session just on the hybrid configuration wizard, Thursday, 4:30 p.m., EXL 303. So if you're interested in a hybrid deployment, highly encourage you to attend that session and get some further detail on how to configure this. Address book policies are the next major feature to talk about here. So, out of curiosity, how many of you have actually used GAL segmentation or some form of multi-tenant hosting with Exchange in the past? A few? How many people have actually deployed HMC, the hosted messaging and collaboration solution? A couple. Okay, good. So let's talk about some history here, just so we're all on the same page about what GAL segmentation is and what our changes actually mean in this area. So the global address list by default in Exchange is effectively a list of all of the mail-enabled objects in an organization, right? So all your users, all your groups, all your rooms, global address list contains everything. Now, there are a number of reasons why that's bad. We run into a lot of cases where, for legal or compliance reasons, companies want to actually be able to segment sets of users, right? There might be a certain department within an organization, say maybe a financial company, where you know, a set of traders might not be able to technically interact with another segment of the user population within that Exchange organization. Not only should they not be allowed to send email to those people outside of their work group, but they shouldn't even be able to see that those people exist, right? As far as they're concerned, they have their own separate Exchange implementation, and they're totally isolated. That's something that we hear a lot as a desirable feature within the product. Some people choose to try and optimize the GAL. They have, you know, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 users in their deployment. They don't want to have a global address list that actually contains that many objects. It becomes unwieldy, hard to browse, et cetera. Obviously, you can create additional address lists that are not the global address list and segment that a bit. That can make you know, browsing a bit easier. But there are certainly customers that we've worked with that choose to try and optimize the GAL for that reason. And then probably the most popular reason for trying to segment the GAL is around hosting or multi-tenancy. And this is not just about commercial hosting, right? You know, a company who wants to deploy Exchange and go sell Exchange mailbox hosting to other companies. This can also be about, I hesitate to use the term private cloud because it has so many different meanings, and I could be talking about any one of them, but I'll explain what I'm trying to get at here. We run into a lot of customers, large customers, who, for whatever reason, want to be able to host, with some air quotes around that, other related companies or organizations, and do it in such a way that it appears that those companies or organizations are in separate Exchange deployments. Typically, they're trying to do this for financial reasons, right, to save money, just have a single Exchange deployment, and maybe do chargeback to other departments who might have otherwise hosted their own Exchange deployment. And sometimes it's done just because, you know, people want to be in the power seat and own Exchange for a very broad set of organizations. And so they want to be able to do this GAL segmentation. And then certainly we do have the commercial hosting as well, but more often than not, it's that sort of internal multi-tenancy that we see customers trying to do. So a little more history on GAL segmentation. In Exchange 2000, we actually released a knowledge base article that explained some ways to do this. We actually ended up pulling that because we released what we considered to be a much better solution for this process that was called the Hosted Messaging and Collaboration Solution from Microsoft. HMC for short. So because we wanted people to deploy HMC instead of utilizing the manual steps that we provided in that knowledge base article, we pulled the KV article down. HMC was really kind of doing the exact same thing behind the scenes, but it also provided a provisioning infrastructure, something that would sort of get you towards a building infrastructure, and a few other pieces that really made it a multi-tenant solution. So in 2003, HMC kind of continued on and supported the 2003 Exchange product. We never created a knowledge base article or any sort of white paper for customers who wanted to do this without deploying HMC. And we got a lot of support cases as a result. We found that people were going out and manually trying to segment their gals in really creative ways. Like I said earlier, you know, we have a lot of flexibility in the product, which leads to a lot of opportunity for people to do some really interesting things. And that caused problems for us from a support perspective and for our customers from a pain perspective when things went wrong. So when Exchange 2007 came around, one of our support engineers actually created a white paper. We call it internally the Dave Goldman paper. And that white paper explained in very specific detail how to perform GAL segmentation within Exchange. And it worked pretty well for 2007. We didn't have a lot of support cases as a result, which is fantastic. So in 2010, we decided that we were tired of messing around with this, right? We wanted to actually build this functionality into the product, stop messing around with support cases, stop messing around with white papers and KBs. The HMC solution actually was discontinued in that time frame as well. So we needed to provide something that would just work out of the box. And we did, and now we're deprecating it, but I'll talk to that in just a second and explain why. So when we think about the way previous solutions in this area worked, they were extremely complex. You basically had to do at least three things to make this work across the different types of access methods within Exchange. So for Outlook access and Exchange Active Sync, you had to set ACLs in the Active Directory on your global address lists and your address lists. So you had to go create security groups and go manually tweak the ACLs in Active Directory in order to limit who could see what. Obviously, there's a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong with that. For OWA, prior to Service Pack 1 of Exchange 2010, we had a, we have an Active Directory attribute called MSX Query Base DN. You can go manually set. There is no good, easy way to do this other than you know, making changes directly in AD. But you could set this to a distinguished name in the Active Directory that defines sort of the base in the AD that limited the other objects that that user could see. So you could go create organizational units in Active Directory and limit what those users could see to a particular organizational unit. That means that, as the slide says, the OU hierarchy is rigid, right? Means that within AD, you're having to be very specific, very thoughtful about where users live. And you can't have a user that lives in more than one OU. This causes some problems for this particular solution. And then for offline address books, we've always had the ability, really, to point specific users to a particular offline address book. So you had to do this. You had to go create segmented offline address books and figure out which one a given user should have access to. So in order to get all this stuff right, obviously you had to build some scripting. There's no way for any reasonable size Exchange deployment to actually guarantee that all this stuff is going to get set properly for every user when they're created. So there was a need to script things. We never really tested Exchange internally to run in this type of deployment. The HMC team certainly tested Exchange and the other components of HMC to run like this. But when we were developing the product, this wasn't part of that core set of automated test cases that we ran. So that resulted in us unintentionally breaking things along the way. That's not a good place to be. And then, as I mentioned, you know, the OU hierarchy dependence really doesn't work for a lot of people. So let's talk about how address book policies address this, and then we'll talk a little bit about what that means for multi-tenant deployments in Exchange 2010, particularly hosted deployments. So in Service Pack 2, out of the box, you get this concept of an address book policy. We provide commandlets that allow you to manage address book policies. We've updated the management console so that you can make changes within EMC as well for administration of ABPs. The idea here is that a user will have an address book policy associated with them. By default, with SP2, you don't really have any address book policies, so there's sort of an implicit default address book policy that your users will have until you go and override that. And an address book policy allows you to assign a global address list, a set of address lists, a room list, and an OAB to that address book policy. And that limits the scope of objects that a particular user can see or can have access to. So in the diagram here, I have a set of directory objects on the bottom, a set of address lists, a set of OABs, a set of GALs, and a set of room address lists. And Mr. User here, up here in the left corner, is a user who I want to give access to GAL 1, room address list 1, OAB B, and a set of address lists. And so I've defined an address book policy that's up here in the upper right that contains those objects. And then I apply that policy to Mr. User. And from that point on, given the access methods that I'll talk about in a minute, those are the set of objects that user can see in the directory. The other things that are in the directory are effectively invisible to that user. So when we think about what actions within Exchange are actually impacted by address book policies, there's a few, obviously, and I would say it's most operations, but there are also a few that I'll call out in a minute, a few things that aren't actually impacted by address book policies that you need to be aware of, because this isn't the perfect solution for hiding things from users or for setting up a multi-tenant solution. So a few areas that this does work as examples. The user goes and opens the address list picker, right? They're going to see the objects that they have access to within that address book policy. They try and resolve a name. If that name is not actually within one of those, within the GAL that user has been assigned, they won't actually resolve it, right? It'll be an external user to them in Outlook, for example. If they go and add a room to a meeting request, they're only going to see the rooms that are on that room list that's associated with their address book policy. And et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to read the entire slide here for you. One important thing to be aware of is around DL membership, and I'll talk in more detail about this in a minute. If you view DL membership, let's say you're going to send an email to a DL in Outlook, and you double-click on that DL, pops open the window that allows you to browse the membership of the DL, that membership list will actually be filtered based on ABP membership. So I will only see the objects in there that I have access to within the ABP that's assigned to me. But when I send that email, transport isn't impacted by ABPs. So it will actually go to everyone on that DL. That's by design. So just important to be aware that as in a few other cases within Exchange where you can have hidden DL membership, or maybe transport rules that are behind the scenes adding recipients to email messages. When you're using address book policies, it is possible that you're sending mail to more people than you think you are. That's the key here. So let's look at a couple of sample deployment scenarios. So one example might be two independent companies that are actually being hosted within the same Exchange organization. And that might be what I was referring to earlier is that case where, for perhaps financial reasons, you have two separate companies that have chosen to, you know, get together and save some money by using a common set of infrastructure. So we have Fabricam and Tailspin, two companies up here. Each of them has their own set of users and DLs, their own set of contacts that are contained in Active Directory, and their own set of rooms. So within each of those, we're going to go ahead and set up some address lists. All right, so I have an address list that contains Fabricams, users and DLs, contacts, and rooms, and the same thing over on the tailspin side. I also have a gal and an OAB for each. So in order to limit what these sets of users can see, I go and create two address book policies, an address book policy fab for Fabricam and tail for tailspin. And within each one of those address book policies, I set the list of address lists and the other objects appropriately. And once I actually apply those address book policies to the users in those containers, they will be limited. They won't be able to see the other objects in the other company. So now let's complicate things a little bit more. Maybe we have a mergers and acquisitions scenario, right? So I have two separate companies, but now I'm sharing a CEO. Maybe we're in the early stages of the M&A process, and the employees of Fabricam shouldn't really know that Tailspin is actually over there and being hosted in the same organization. But Big Boss here in the center needs to be able to contact everyone. He should know that he should be able to see all those objects in the directory. So the way we're set up currently is the same way we were set up on the previous slide, where users in Fabricam can't see users in Tailspin and vice versa. But we want to ensure that Big Boss can see everyone. So what do we need to do? Well, we create an address book policy where the address lists is the set of all of the address lists that exist. The gal is actually the default gal with Exchange, which is everything. The room address list is the same, the default all rooms address list that contains all the rooms, and he gets the default OAB. So at this point, when Big Boss uses any of the supported access methods to get into Exchange, he sees everything. Everyone in Fabricam sees all the users in Fabricam and sees Big Boss, and the same thing for Tailspin. They see users within Tailspin and Big Boss. So problem solved there. The last deployment scenario that I want to walk through is actually a very common one that we've been dealing with quite a bit lately. That's the education scenario. This is one where things can get really complicated with address book policies. So it demonstrates some of the power of this technology. So walking through this, we have two classes of students. Each of those has a teacher, and there's a principal at the school. Right? So we have users that are actually the students in each of these classes. And we need to be able to segment directory access so that the right people can see the right things in AD, but still provide limits. And those limits that we're going to define are that students in class A cannot see students in class B. That's the key here. So we're going to go and create some address lists. We're going to create a set of address lists for each class. And we can do that in any way that you would create an address list today to focus on a particular set of users, right? We might have directory attributes that have like a class ID number that we can filter based on. We're going to create an address list for all teachers. So maybe we have a title in Active Directory that we can filter on to get those teachers. Same thing for students. Maybe we're defining students' titles as student in Active Directory, so we can filter on that. And then we'll have an all groups address list. Now that we have those address lists, we can go and start creating address book policies. So for class A, we're going to give them three address lists. The class A address list, so they can see the students in class A. The all teachers address list, so they can see all the teachers, even outside of the teacher for class A. And the all groups address list, so they can send to groups within the school. And their default address list, or their global address list, will be a gal for class A. So within that, if I'm a user in class A, a student, if I go look at class A all, which is a DL there, I see three members. I see, you can actually see the colors coordinating there. I can see student one in class A, I can see the teacher, and I can see the principal. Right? If I go look at class B, I don't see the student that's actually in class B. I just see the teacher and the principal, because I'm not allowed to see students in the other classes. Everyone contains everyone except for the student in the other class, and faculty contains all the faculty, because I'm allowed to see all the faculty. So then I do the same thing to provide different access for the principal. In this case, I'm going to create a global address list for the principal that allows the principal to see everything, right? And I'm going to allow the principal to see all of the address lists. So over here on the right, if I go look at class A and B and look at who's in all of them, I can see everyone, right? All of those, all the objects are available to me as the principal. So it allows you a fair amount of flexibility to configure the directory access in the way that you need to based on whatever the business scenario is. So it's important to remember that proper deployment of ABPs is really all about planning. Anytime you're trying to structure your Active Directory to meet business requirements, there's a lot of thought that needs to go into how to do that properly, right? Same thing with how you actually associate address book policies with those directory objects. So ABPs don't result in true separation. This is very critical to understand. There are ways to get around ABPs, and it doesn't truly give you a multi-tenant solution. So I mentioned the transport scenario earlier. If you send a message to a DL, transport isn't going to go look at the ABP that's associated with the sender and do the right thing. It's just going to send to the members of the DL, right? It doesn't know that ABPs exist. The key scenario for people bypassing ABPs is for clients that actually connect directly to an Active Directory domain controller to get access to Exchange objects. There's a few examples of that. Anyone out here use Entourage or Mac Outlook? Yeah, a few? So that would be probably the biggest example of a client that actually connects directly to Active Directory. So the current versions of Mac Outlook will actually resolve names against Exchange. They'll do an Exchange Web Services call to Exchange in order to resolve a name. That actually will use ABPs. So if you're trying to resolve names in Mac Outlook, your ABP will define who you can resolve. But if you actually go in and choose to browse the address list, that's done using LDAP, the LDAP protocol, directly against an Active Directory domain controller. And in that case, the ABPs wouldn't apply. So you can see everything. As a result, we typically see customers choosing to block that LDAP access to their domain controllers if that's a problem. So there are ways to force people down the path of using the ABPs, but you need to plan for it. Additionally, if you install Exchange on a global catalog server, which we don't recommend for a number of reasons, but you can do, in that case, the code that actually is responsible for filtering the address book views within Outlook or any other client that uses what we call the Name Service Provider Interface, NSPI, you actually won't see that filtering occurring because in that case, NSPI is being provided by Active Directory and not Exchange on that global catalog server. So if you're going to use ABPs, you really do not want to install Exchange on your GCs. Important to remember that. Exchange Control Panel also has one particular area around group management where it does not deal properly with ABPs or with limiting visibility into objects. So be aware that you may want to disable ECP or at least portions of ECP for your users if you choose to deploy ABPs. Another key point here, Office 365 is popular these days, something that I think we've all heard quite a bit about already, and we'll continue to hear more so over the week. ABPs don't actually work in Office 365 yet. There's a couple of reasons for this. Probably the biggest being that in order to administer ABPs, you actually need to be able to create OABs and create address lists and things of this nature. And we don't provide the ability to do that today. So even if we did provide the new address book policy commandlet, it wouldn't actually really give you the ability to do anything. So we have some work to do on our side to actually go and enable the creation of these types of objects, these types of configuration objects for Exchange in the cloud. And that is something that is on our roadmap that we're working on actively. But until we get there, if you are in a hybrid configuration where you have some users in your on-premises deployment and some users in the cloud, the users that are in the cloud that are in Office 365, regardless of whether or not their mailbox has an ABP applied to it, we'll see everything. So just be aware of that if you are in a hybrid environment or considering going to that. So let's talk a little bit about commercial hosting and hosting mode, which we introduced with Exchange 2010. So I mentioned in the history portion of the talk that in Exchange 2010, we decided to kind of solve the multi-tenant directory access problem once and for all, or the GAL segmentation problem once and for all. And we did that by providing a setup option that we call hosting mode. So you can run setup.com/hosting, and it will change the way Exchange actually configures itself, and it'll change the schema, actually, in Active Directory that Exchange uses to store information. And as a result of that, once you've made the decision to be in hosting mode, that forest will always be in hosting mode. You can't actually change it into normal mode or non-hosting mode ever. You'd have to deploy a new forest. The flip side to that is true as well. If you wanted to deploy in hosting mode, you would have to be in a forest that hadn't had Exchange deployed in it previously. So that was one big limitation, or is one big limitation of hosting mode. The other is that the way we designed hosting mode was basically to use the same code that we use for Office 365 to manage multi-tenancy and to manage the directory and the directory schema. And as a result, all of the limitations that we have with Office 365 today, things like no public folders, also apply to this type of deployment. And that's a problem. We got a lot of feedback from customers that this was actually not acceptable, that they really wanted to be able to use the directory configuration that we provide with hosting mode, where there's a separate container within Active Directory for each organization, and access is perfectly scoped to each one of those organizations, but they wanted all of the functionality in the product. So we got into this interesting case where customers didn't want to deploy hosting mode because it didn't meet their needs, but because no one deployed hosting mode, we didn't really see a reason to change that. And so in Exchange SP2, we've actually made a little bit of a change in our, actually a major change in our guidance around hosted deployments. And that is, we recommend that no one deploy hosting mode. It's still there. It's in the product. It will continue to be supported through the normal support lifecycle of Exchange 2010, but we are being very clear that we're not going to make any changes to hosting mode. We're not going to add features to it. We're not going to do anything to make it better beyond what's in the product today. We'll fix issues that occur, fix bugs, but we're not going to add features for hosting mode. That's the key point here. With the introduction of address book policies, we've made it possible to deploy a multi-tenant hosted solution in a different way. And so ABPs are a part of a hosted solution that provide GAL segmentation, but they don't provide any of the provisioning process or any of the billing infrastructure connections or anything like that that you would actually really need to get a multi-tenant solution. So we built a partner program, and we're relying on some of our partners that have been delivering solutions in this space for a very long time to actually help us out here. So we, the Exchange product team, created some guidance about the best way to deploy an Exchange-hosted solution. And that guidance actually helps to define supportability. Actually, really does define supportability, but it has a little bit of flexibility in it. So it's not really the final word. It's not a firm specification. So we've actually worked with our partners to help them create Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2 ready solutions that you can deploy that will be supported by Microsoft for a multi-tenant Exchange deployment. This is something you want to do. Highly encourage you to take a look at the URL that's in the slide deck. You'll see links to the solutions that we've already approved and you know have gone through a very stringent review process with. And you can also see the very specific guidance documentation that we created to work with those partners. The other thing to remember here is that if you do want to build your own solution for multi-tenant hosting for whatever reason, you can actually go look at that guidance and build your own system. And as long as you are within that guidance, Microsoft will support you as well, in the same way they would support you if you deployed one of these approved solutions. So there's a number of options there. We also provide some scale guidance, which we haven't been very good about providing historically for these types of deployments. So we think this is a much better way to handle multi-tenancy and hosting solutions. You can actually use the full functionality of the product. We think it's much more supportable. We think we're in a better situation in terms of finding bugs in the product and continuing to improve quality over time because it's much more aligned with our vision for where we want our customers and partners to be. We understand how the product's going to be deployed so we can test better for those scenarios. All right. Quick breather here. Last major feature in SP2 that we're going to talk about is OAuth cross-site silent redirection. And this, quite frankly, it's kind of embarrassing to me that it took us until Service Pack 2 to make this work, because it's really not that challenging to make happen. But let's talk about what it is and how we made it work and why you're going to love it. So before Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2, if you had a multi-site deployment, and many of you do, it's a very, very common way to deploy Exchange if you're trying to do high availability in multiple data centers or trying to segment things in AD sites for a number of other reasons. If you actually connect to OAuth in what we will call the wrong site, where the wrong site means a site other than where your mailbox is actively running on a mailbox server, that client access server has a decision to make at that point about how to provide OAuth to you. And that decision is going to involve whether or not it should proxy that connection to a CAS in the correct site and provide you with that UI. And if it does that, you know, that proxy connection will give you single sign-on. You won't actually see an additional login dialog. That's not necessarily the best way to go, though. There are network bandwidth and latency reasons that you might not want to do that. And there are other various configuration reasons that you might not want to do that. You may actually want your users connecting to the correct URL when they come into the organization. So if we actually have an external URL defined in the site where we're, the correct site where the mailbox exists, we'll proxy, mailbox opens, user moves on just fine. Reverse. If there's no external URL, we proxy. If there is an external URL, you get that dreaded pop-up in OAuth that says, you came to the wrong place. Bad user. Why did you do that? Here's the correct URL to go to. You know, please remember that URL in the future. Go there directly. You won't have this extra step in the process. So the user clicks on that link, sees the OAuth login screen again, has to type their credentials in all over again, and then they get their mail. So they had to log in twice. Why did we do that? Well, that's an excellent question. But I'm going to ignore answering that and move on to say that we fixed it. You don't have to do that anymore. So if you're using forms-based auth and have everything secured in the right way, you can get single sign-on in this way. So this functionality in Service Pack 2 is actually disabled by default out of the box. You have to make the choice to enable this. We didn't want to change the way users are accessing their mailboxes without an administrator making that specific choice. Because some people actually like the way it works today. And if you're one of them, you can keep it as is. So as I mentioned, you do have to be using forms-based auth to make this work. And I'll explain why in a second when I talk about how it works behind the scenes. So in order to enable it, you're basically setting a parameter on OAuth virtual directories. It's the cross-site redirect type parameter that you can set on OAuth virtual directories. If you set that to silent, you will get this behavior if and only if the other requirements are there. You need to have an external URL that we can redirect to, and you need to have FBA, forms-based auth, enabled. If those aren't both true, then you won't get this behavior. So what does this actually look like? So here's the experience prior to the change that we made. So I'm a user. I'm working for Fabricam Inc., and I go to redmond.fabricam.com, which is the Redmond, Washington site where my company has their headquarters. And I choose to log in. And as a result of that, I discover, unfortunately, that my mail, my mailbox is actually running in the London site currently. And that could have been due to a high availability change, could have been due to my mailbox getting moved to that site. Number of reasons that can happen, right? But I'm told at this point, you went to the wrong place, bad user, click here, and we can give you access to your mailbox. So I've typed my credentials in once, I click on the link, and I end up on the London site's logon page all over again. So I type in my credentials, and I get access to my mailbox running in London. So now we've deployed SP2. My IT pro has gone in and made the right decision to enable this functionality, gone and set that flag on all my OAuth virtual directories in Redmond, and in London for that matter, so I can get the same behavior in both directions. And I go to Redmond, I log in, and what happens? I go directly to London, I'm logged in, I get access to my mailbox. No other interaction necessary. So that's cross-site silent redirection. Thank you. A few applause. So how does it work behind the scenes? It's actually extraordinarily simple. It works exactly the same way that redirection works for single sign-on when we redirect to a legacy namespace from Exchange 2010 to Exchange 2007, if your mailbox is on 2007. So when we realize within the OAuth code that we need to do that redirect, instead of sending a redirect status code back to the user or to the user's browser and giving them the page with the URL that they need to click on, we send them an HTML page. We give them a 200 OK message. We send them an HTML page that's dynamically generated by OAuth. And that page has a form in it. You never see this, but it has a login form in it with all the fields pre-filled in with the information that you provided in that first logon page. And we have a very tiny little bit of JavaScript in there that says, when that page is loaded, submit the form. And so your browser submits the form, and it submits it to the CAS server in the destination site. That CAS server processes the login request and does exactly what would have happened if you logged into that site yourself, right? It processes the login, creates your OAuth session, and sends you to the main OAuth UI. So extraordinarily simple behind the scenes. If you turn off JavaScript in your browser, this is one of the very many things in OAuth that would stop working because we rely on that JavaScript submit. But that's what's going on behind the scenes. So I'm going to briefly talk about what's going on, or one of the changes that occurred in Update Rollup 3, and then we'll have some time for questions before Scott Schnull gets up here and talks about SP2 tips and tricks. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we're constantly going through and refreshing the product in terms of fixing issues that we've found in the field, issues that we've found internally, issues that we've found in Office 365, frankly, that we realize will actually have applicability to customers who are deploying on-premises. And as a result of all those changes, we release update roll-ups into the field. We call them RUs, but they're truly update roll-ups, URs. So I apologize for the juxtaposition there. But RU3 is update roll-up 3. And one of the changes that we've made in update roll-up 3 is a change around recoverable items versioning and how we deal with storage for versions in the recoverable items store. And I wanted to briefly cover this just to give you an idea of some of the kind of constant tune-ups that we're making in the product to make sure that you're having the best experience possible. One thing I will call out here, we actually do a reasonably good job of talking about these types of changes on the Exchange Team blog. So if you're not already familiar with the Exchange Team blog, you'll see it at the end of my deck in the resources slide. It's a great way to stay abreast of what's actually changing in the product in these types of updates. There's actually a great article out there written by one of my colleagues on the specifics of this particular change. So in Exchange 2010, we made some changes to what we call the dumpster. Many of you that have been working with Exchange for a long time are familiar with the dumpster. It's kind of that hidden area of the mailbox where we choose to hang on to some information for a period of time after you've deleted it. That's kind of the historical definition of what the dumpster was. We don't really like to delete things in Exchange. So you know that when you're in Outlook, when you delete something, it goes into the deleted items folder. And then when you delete it out of the deleted items folder, you might think it's deleted, but it's in the dumpster. And then eventually Exchange will delete it after that, after the configured time has gone by. Well, in Exchange 2010, with single item recovery and the litigation hold functionality that's in the product, we made some changes to how we store that information and the types of information that we store in the dumpster. And we called that Dumpster 2.0 or the Recoverable Item Store 2.0. One of the things that we store there are versions of changed items. So rather than just storing things that have been deleted so that they could be recovered individually, we also have this behavior in Exchange 2010 where if you change certain types of content, we will actually do what we call a copy on write. So we'll actually store the original copy of that content in the recoverable item store and then save the new version in your mailbox or wherever you've chosen to save it so that all of that information is discoverable for compliance purposes, for legal purposes, et cetera. There are some problems with our initial implementation of this that we've been finding since Exchange 2010 was released. And one of them or this one in particular, is kind of an interesting interaction between our best client, the Outlook client, that we love so dearly, and the way it actually operates on items that are in your mailbox. So given that we perform this copy on write behavior when items are changed, the problem occurs when I open an item in my mailbox. We'll just say it's a calendar item and it has an attachment in it. I open up that item, and then I choose to edit the attachment. This is actually a much more common scenario than you might imagine. Because of the autosave functionality that's been in the Office products for many versions, Outlook, behind the scenes, is going to start autosaving on a schedule. And each time it does that, those saves actually trigger copy on writes. And they're triggering copy on writes both for the item itself, that calendar item, as well as the attachment. And I might actually have multiple attachments in there. And as a result of having multiple attachments, I'm actually going to do a copy on write for each one of the attachments and the item at that autosave interval. So we found that customers who, for whatever reason, within their business processes, commonly perform these activities, they would actually have huge amounts of data in their recoverable item store that they really didn't need to have, right? Since the attachments are actually stored effectively as part of the item itself, really all we need to do is save the item, not the attachments individually, as part of that copy on write behavior. So in RU3, this is an example of something that you just get out of the box without doing anything, just by deploying the update rollup. We actually only generate a version, a copy on write version, for the item, not for those individual attachments as well. So we found that this results in a really dramatic reduction in the amount of data stored in the recoverable item store for customers that are taking advantage of this. So that's just one example of many things that we do in roll-up updates to tune the perf, to tune storage utilization, and in general to try and make the product better, more reliable, just a better exchange across the board. So with that, I'm going to briefly go through a couple of key points here, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. I will ask, if you do have questions, that you come up to the mics. We are recording the session, and so it would be great to get the questions recorded as well. We do have a couple of related breakout sessions, and actually, I would encourage you to see all the Exchange sessions you can while you're here. But there are a couple of key ones that are related to what I've talked about today. The first being the Exchange 2010 SP2 Tips and Tricks session, which is in this room, right after I'm done. So, you know, very easy to see that session. Just stay exactly where you are. Low effort. That one's a great session, and it will be repeated as well if you do need to get somewhere else to to see another session this afternoon. It'll be repeated later in the week. We also have, as I mentioned, a hybrid session for how to configure hybrid with Office 365. Highly encourage you to see that if that's something you're interested in doing. We have a couple of key track resources to point out. I mentioned the Exchange Team blog. Great place to stay in touch with the Exchange Team and understand what we've released in the latest update roll-ups and what we're thinking in terms of best practices and the types of feedback that we're getting from the field. The Geek Out with Perry blog, Perry Clark, one of my favorite Exchange people at Microsoft. Perry does a great job of walking you through very complex aspects of how Exchange works behind the scenes and some of the decisions that we've made in the development process. He's actually the director of development for Exchange, and he has some very key insights into why we do what we do and why Exchange is designed as it is. So highly recommend you check that out. The last link here talks about mech. I actually have a slide that calls out mech specifically. If you're at all interested in the next release of Exchange, I highly encourage you to consider attending MEC, the Microsoft Exchange Conference, which is actually also going to be in Orlando at the end of September. And that will be the technical conference to talk about Exchange 15. We will also be talking a bit about the current release of Exchange as well. But really, the focus will be very in-depth technical discussions around Exchange 15, the changes that we've made in that release, and really providing an opportunity to answer all the questions that you have and give you a great opportunity to talk directly in small interactive discussions with those of us on the product team. So highly encourage you to take a look at MEC and consider attending later this summer. And I will skip forward here to my reminder to you to please complete an evaluation. We love the feedback. So I'll leave this up on the screen. You can scan the tag, complete your evaluation while you're sitting there, and I'll go ahead and open it up for questions. If anyone has any questions about Service Pack 2, any of the content that I talked through, or anything else really Exchange related you want to ask.
Phil Braniff at Boeing.
Hi.
And I had a question about the room, all rooms mailbox in the global address list, and question about breaking that up into like state boundaries, because we're kind of large, and we in the past we've lost the features and the capacities displays in that list, in those sublists. Is that changed with no?
Okay. Yeah, address book policies don't solve that. You have a room list that's assigned to or that's associated with an address book policy that's assigned to a user. It's not a set of room lists, unfortunately. So yeah, it doesn't, for that particular scenario, it doesn't honestly really help.
Okay.
You're up.
Michael Cass from Pfizer. Question, back in Exchange 2003, we had this great OWA log on splash screen. You could have a front-end server somewhere, let's say on the East Coast, somewhere on the West Coast, at different Active Directory sites, different Exchange sites as well. And it was one logon. There was no redirection. There was nothing like that necessary. You talked before about trying to improve and not regress. And when you talked about 2007 and 2010, you know, forcing the redirection in the sites seemed like a regression to me. Is there any chance that we'd be able to get back to a place where we could allow people to have a single URL? This silent redirection is great, but we're still going to get questions, and there's still a lot of buzz about why do I see a different URL than my colleague or coworker.
So I think all I can really say on that at the moment, given that we have a new release, you know, coming, that's feedback that we've certainly heard, and that, you know, we will certainly try to address. Can't talk about whether or not that is, you know, specifically something we've changed in the next release. But yeah, I hear that. Cross-site silent redirection, other than the URL, solves the issue that you're referring to. But the fact is that the URL does change visibly for the user. So yeah, there is certainly an opportunity for your users to be confused and call help desk or whatever, be a little upset about that. So I wouldn't expect anything in the 2010 release that will directly address that, other than what we've talked about here. Yep, down front.
Hi, my name is Brian. I had a question about OAuth Mini. Mm-hmm. We use Forefront and two-factor authentication to protect our client access architecture for Exchange.
Okay.
What is being extended to incorporate that for Mini?
So Forefront and two-factor auth. Basically nothing. So when you say Forefront, you're talking about TMG or UAG?
Right, right. TMG.
Okay. TMG. In the case of OAuth Mini, when we set up OAuth Mini by default, we actually set it up to use basic auth. We can't OAuth Mini doesn't work with forms-based auth. We don't have a forms-based login page specific to OAuth Mini. So from the perspective of auth, we're expecting basic auth credentials. There may be something you can do with Forefront to actually do the two-factor auth for you up front, and in some way pass the credentials through. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a way to do that with basic auth creds, but you know, we might be able to brainstorm something.
But under the covers, it's expecting basic only?
Yes.
There's no other forms of authentication?
Yeah, that's the way it's configured. But yeah, I mean, if you want to stop by the booth this evening or tomorrow evening, happy to try and whiteboard something out and see if we can figure out a way to do that. Yep.
Hello. I know that in SP2 there's some schema extensions. Can you expand on what they are?
Sure. So, okay, actually, Scott's going to cover them in the next session. Are you going to hang around for tips and tricks? You don't want to hurt Scott's feelings. We can talk after. I don't want to ruin Scott's talk, so. Next.
Any news on the future of MRM V1 and folder-based journaling?
MRM V1 and folder-based journaling. I'm not aware of plans to change anything beyond what we've done so far with MRM changes through SP2.
Is it going to be supported in Office 365 in any fashion?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, my name is Michael. We're in the middle of migrating from Exchange 2007 to Exchange 2010. And I was just wondering about address lists. Mm-hmm. Why was it changed from LDAP to OPATH the way you filter them? And thank you for the work, by the way.
I don't know the internal reason for why we made that change. Anybody down front know why we made the change? Nope? Okay. Okay, the answer I'm getting from my colleagues is that I'm right. It was just because. I honestly don't know. And yeah, admittedly, that's a... Not everyone likes OPATH. We hear that.
It does mean that there are some... attributes that we cannot use, that we use today. Okay.
Yep, understood.
Great.
Heard the feedback. Yeah, so as Robert points out, LDAP filters still work. It's just a matter of the configuration interface. So.
Hey, managed folders is deprecated right now. Is it going to be back at all? Let's say we have a requirement to push out a standard folder to all the users' mailboxes. How do we do that? You know, I mean, right now, I can do it through managed folders through the PowerShell, but it's deprecated. So I really don't want to start a new venture or anything like that in case we're not going to be supported or we don't know that. How does it work?
Okay, so it sounds like Bharat's actually going to talk about that in his, is it archiving and compliance? Yeah, the archiving and compliance session. So highly encourage you to go to Bharat's session and listen to that. All right. I guess that's it. Thank you, everyone. Really appreciate it. And stay around for Scott's session. It'll be awesome.